Okay, good morning.
Let's get started. Who's gonna take notes? So, what I want to start with is a simple question.
Of course, if I'm asking, it's probably not so simple.
What's the difference between a program having a backdoor and a program having a logic error that leads to a security vulnerability?
One is usually purposefully done.
Okay, so this is on purpose. This is accidental. So there's a difference in motive.
The backdoor probably ships with the software, whereas the logic error most likely discovered.
Well, technically they were.
I mean, they're the same thing.
Okay, so that's interesting. Okay, so that's fine. Accidental, this was discovered. This was engineered. What else is the difference?
Logic errors don't always lead to the same thing that the backdoors would.
What do you mean?
A logic error would generally not give you the same privileges as readily as a backdoor would. You can exploit a logic error to gain more privileges, but a backdoor just gives them to you.
So let's say severe impact. Variable impact.
Let me phrase this another way. If you're a very determined attacker and you wish to insert a backdoor in a piece of software that will not be discovered or removed, how do you construct such a backdoor? There's one thing to get the code in there. I'm saying is, how do you construct the code in such a way that it is not likely to be discovered or removed? You'd have to obfuscate it. If you stick regular obfuscation in production code, if another developer looks at it, they'll go like, that code is obfuscated. I can't understand it. What is that doing here?
Mm-hmm. You place it into something or somewhere where it's already doing something that's related to what you need to do.
Right.
So hiding it within something else.
Right. Well, yeah, you want to hide it somewhere else.
I mean, like when you say obfuscated, obfuscation like could also mean like a tiny bit over here, a tiny
right.
bit over there, and
right.
so I can create like a tiny bit there.
Right. What I'm trying to get at, isn't clear already, is that to a sophisticated attacker, you can't tell the difference between a logic error and a backdoor. They look like the exact same thing. I mean, you may know about the motives, but people have made all kinds of mistakes that have resulted in ridiculous compromises. Some of them are we know what logic errors look like. An attacker can get quite a bit of access through appropriately placed logic errors. So if you're an attacker and you want to insert a subtle backdoor, you make it look like a logic error. The only difference, I mean, there's obvious backdoors,
There are things like, if password equals, you know, abracadabra, let them in, you know? But those sort of backdoors are obvious from introspection. I mean, there are, authentication bypasses that resulted from an extra semicolon, you know, or something, or like one character differences that look like it could have easily been a typo in the source code that you would not see normally reading it. That leads to a backdoor, effectively. But it's an error in logic. So the only difference at a fundamental level between a backdoor and, you know, and a logic error is motive. If you're looking for security problems, there's no difference. At least if you're talking obvious backdoors, sure, there's a difference. Subtle backdoors, no difference at all.
So you're saying, when you say that how you code a backdoor such that it's difficult to discover,
yes,
you mean discover that it is a backdoor, not that there is a backdoor?
No, I'm saying is you have an attacker, they go in, they introduce a logic error.
Right, okay.
That, in fact, opens up a backdoor that allows for security to be bypassed for someone who knows the nature of the vulnerability. Which is all a backdoor is.
I mean, some of the easiest and least detected backdoors, if they have already a bunch of users in their database, you can just add another one with high privileges.
Yes. But that's not so good.
No.
From an attacker perspective, because if you have a regular user, they are subject to all the regular controls, which may include monitoring, may include logging, things. So it's if you want to really be stealthy, a highly privileged user is not how you want to be into the system. In fact, actually, it's often better to be a low privileged user because those are less monitored. In a lot of attacks, you need less privilege, depending on what it is. So the reason I'm bringing this up now is when we're talking about software vulnerabilities and talking about attackers, it's often easy to get into this mindset of, oh, there's the things we do by accident, and yeah, we can probably get rid of those, versus, oh yeah, attackers, if they get control of the code, they'll do bad things. From the perspective of the phenomena of having insecure software, there is no difference between these. Because for a security researcher, you know, an adversary who's going around analyzing code, if they find a vulnerability in software that allows them to get access, maybe they didn't put it there on purpose, but once they found it and if other people don't know about it, it's as good as a backdoor. I mean, there's a difference in how they originate, but in effect, they're exactly the same. And this really matters if you're trying to think about defenses. Because if you just care about backdoors, you say, okay, I have to make sure only trusted people write my code. I have to make sure I have good, you know, processes, and I make sure people vet it and stuff like that. And there's all these things about making sure trustworthy people do things because you're worried about intentionality. Logic errors, there's no intentionality. It's just a phenomena. And you can say, well, we can try reducing the number of errors we make. We can try to improve quality. But that at best can reduce the occurrence of these. That will not eliminate these. So when you have any application and you're wondering whether it's, you know, is it vulnerable or not, you have to kind of assume you have both. Because for first approximation, they're exactly the same thing. And in fact, it can even be, oh, this software is secure today. Tomorrow, oh, there's a major zero-day vulnerability in it. because you find out about this. Well, it turns out the day before, someone who knew about that 0 day on day minus one, or day minus two, you know, before, that was a backdoor for them. It's functionally the same.
So what does this suggest as a defender? This suggests that any strategy for trying to deal with software vulnerabilities that tries to make sure that only trusted individuals make code changes and that you do things for quality engineering, even if you do both, you're still not out of the woods. Right? Because mistakes will be made and attackers will get access. And the difference between you can't necessarily tell.
So what do you do about the gap? You don't have to answer that today. But that's something I want you to be thinking about is, because it's the attacking part of computer security is fun. Because it's fun to break things. It's like, it's fun to play with guns and explosives and watch things go boom, because they blow them up. And then someone comes along and says, I'd like to build a building that isn't easy to blow up. And then you go, oh crap. You go, how do I do this? And you go like, well, I can make it not able to be blown up if you're willing to have no windows, if you're willing to, pay five times the cost of what you would have paid otherwise, if you're willing to have people only come in. I mean, there's all these restrictions you start putting in and you go like, okay. Now, we kind of have an intuitive understanding of that sort of difference in the physical world. We don't have an intuitive sense of that in a software world. What does it mean to say, oh, this is an armored bunker, ready to take a direct hit from a nuclear missile versus this is your average school? Those two, we don't, what does that look like from a software perspective? Because in fact, you look at the actual code, you look at the way code is actually run, it's all the same stuff. The US military does all their work on Windows, as does the Canadian military. All their internal processes, they're always in Windows. You look at a lot of these weapons systems, they're using commercial off-the-shelf software for good portions of their systems. Yes, it's militarized and hardened and they've got mil specs and whatever things, but it's the same code. At least, it may be configured slightly differently. But this...
I was just going to say that in between XP, what spawned Vista was the fact that Microsoft no longer understood a lot of their code. So they rewrote it.
No, they still don't understand their code.
Yeah, they still...
Nobody understands... So when we say that people understand code, that's always a lie. It is possible... this is a fundamental fact of modern software. You never understand your code. You may think you understand it. You may say, I understand this function. I understand this module. I understand this library. Okay, so you may think I understand this, but that understanding does not scale. And that understanding, even you think of that little piece, is limited because you put that code into an environment in which you have not used it before. Almost always, you will see new behavior. You go like, wow, I didn't know my code did that. Oh, look, that was a bug that never manifested in another environment. Does anyone know how you get portable code? How do you design code to be portable?
You bring the environment with you?
That's not. That's pushing the
problem.
That's
not
so
normal.
That's what I was going to say. There's only one, so there's lots of principles. You say, okay, abstract away the way you do I.O., and you want to worry about endianness, worry about this stuff, but that's all crap. There's only one way to write portable code. You port it. You port it, watch it break, fix it. Do it again. The Linux kernel is very portable now. When the Linux kernel was originally built, it was designed for the i3, the 86 processor, on the PC architecture.
Yeah.
And now it runs everywhere. Is it because Linus Torvalds was a genius in terms of how he architected Linux?
No.
No. Not at all. What happened was, is people took the code and started porting it. And as they ported it, they go like, oh, I made this different version. Oh, here, I had to hack on this, this, this. And they go like, oh my God, that's such ugly hacks. I don't like that. I don't want that in my code. Let's try code with better abstraction so that that's all nice and clean. And so they go, okay, now this is good. And someone else says, oh, I now tried writing on this. Oh yeah, this broke. I could have, oh. Okay, I better refactor this. It's like, oh yeah, it runs on this thing, but the performance is horrible because it does this. Assume this. Okay, now we're going to. That's how you make portable code. Is by going through that process of iteratively doing it. Now, but this, if you really understand that process, you go like, wait a second. Should I have designed it that way in the first place? But you didn't know enough to design it in the first place. So many security evangelists will state that now let's understand what the statement really is. So, you know, security must be built in from the beginning. Replace security with any other property you want. Portability must be built in from the beginning. Performance must be built in from the beginning. I mean, what's the factor? It's like, if you don't put it in at the building and you try to introduce it later, you experience pain. So certainly effort invested early on in a software engineering process that takes into account requirements makes it easier to solve those requirements. Well, to satisfy those requirements. Yeah. That's always true. But what is the requirement for you to do this for any property? You have to understand it. You have to understand the requirements. You have to understand what it means. If you don't understand what it means, you can't design for it. So I bring up portability because it's a clear example of the designers not understanding the nature of the problem. Because if you really start, if you have, say, I need to target these five systems, and you know that at the very beginning, you can maybe say, okay, let's make a design that targets those five systems. Then someone comes up, oh, there is this sixth system. But if you design it for five systems, okay, fine, you know, there's a sixth system. But of course, everyone knows developing something from the beginning for five systems is a sure recipe of extending your development timeline and making everything more painful and stuff because you have so many requirements to satisfy at the same time. So what do we normally do is let's get it working on one system. Think maybe a bit about the other systems and try to do that, and then iteratively build it, port it over. We understand this. This is how we do things. There's clear reasons for how we do this. Why is security different?
Because security keeps getting broken.
Well, no, but it keeps getting broken. certainly. But that's not fundamentally different from anything else in terms of what, when we say security is broken, what that really means is that your requirements have changed. Your requirements have changed such that, there is this attack. It might be a very general attack. It might be a very specific attack. I do not want my system to be compromised in the face of this attack. Was that a requirement you planned for when you built your system? No. Your requirements changed. And so now you have to adapt your code to it.
I'm going to take a guess, but more security usually means you're closing off your code more, if that makes sense. So that sort of makes it.
Reducing functionality certainly does tend to lead to greater security, but it also leads to less functionality, which is problematic. I mean, the most secure system is a system that's off in a locked safe, not connected to anything. I mean, that's very secure, right? It just doesn't do anything. So, what I'm trying to get at with all this is thinking about software engineering from a security perspective. What are you actually trying to do? And people often think of this as a very different thing from the other kinds of software engineering you have to do, the other kinds of requirements. Fundamentally, the only difference is the requirements keep changing. And they keep changing because you don't understand the nature of the problem when you first develop your application. You can try to anticipate the nature of the problem to some degree, and if that degree you can, you build it in. And certainly in this day and age, for certain classes of applications, you know that these are attacks you should care about, and so you should take some steps to mitigate them. And if you can do that at the beginning, you'll be better off. But security is a set of requirements that keep changing because attack strategies keep changing, and those attack strategies are changing with respect to your code. It's an adaptive set of adaptively changing set of requirements. But that notion of adaptively changing set of requirements is actually inherent to what we do with software. Because always, you build an application, people look at it and go like, wouldn't this feature be nice? Wouldn't it be great if it did this? Wouldn't it do that? Oh, I really hate how it does this. The more we live with a piece of software, the more it gets connected, the requirements keep changing, and so we have to keep changing our code. Software security is exactly the same thing. So once you take on that kind of mindset, this looks different. How does it look different? This is a problem of, both of these are problems of changing requirements. I mean, you can have a requirement saying, I don't want my software to have backdoors. But that's like saying, the application should be fast. It's a nice requirement. My application should be user-friendly. Yes, that's a requirement that is utterly useless in terms of building an actual system. You can't do anything with it. These are requirements. These are saying, my program should not have a logic error here. It should have this kind of logic. My program should not take weird input, like a abracadabra password, and then it should do that. They're just, these are the kind of requirements that you can never list, which is really why the notion of building software from requirements is fundamentally broken. Because we can never fully specify the true requirements. It's an open-ended set, because whatever you say, this is the requirements, and then you go, okay, well, what about this? And it's either going to be, well, of course, because that's understood, based on what other thing to say. Or, oh, I didn't think about that. That isn't covered. And you might say, well, why can't we just say that? But because we all don't understand the world in the same way. We all don't see the same way. We write the same words. We say a sentence to each other, and what the other person understood and what we thought we said can be very, very different. This is not... Communication is fundamentally hard because communication is about changing state and it's always in the context of previous state. So you can't ever be sure exactly what's been communicated. I mean, we have all the ways of trying to do this better, but it's not an easy problem. And that's all we're doing when we're developing systems. And so requirements are not anything magical. They're just a way of communicating what things should be done. And that communication is always limited and imperfect. You know, people outside of security will say, well, why can't we just tell me what my requirements are, tell me what I need to do, and I'll build my software that way? It's like, does that work for any other aspect of software? Ever? No. It never does. I mean, and the systems that are the worst engineered software are the ones where people try to come up with the most precise requirements at the beginning. You've all seen this. When someone says, you're going to do this, exactly this, when they try this very precise thing, you then start following it, and it leads to crap code. Good code, if you've ever seen good code, it's never been just like, oh, someone had a perfect and, you know, perfectly specified thing and then produced the code. No. A code artist engineered the code and think about that with taste and put it there and made something that was elegant, that solved the problem. And when it's done really well, it not just solves the problem that you have today, but you realize that the problem you have tomorrow is also almost solved in the code, and that you have to make very small changes, and now the new requirements are solved. That's beautiful code. And that does not come from requirements. So security is this. So certainly some code will be more secure than others. Some people will make more mistakes. But if you want to get past this problem, we're going to do more things of talking about the vulnerability specifically, because of course talking about this in generalities doesn't necessarily help you really develop the intuitions about what you need to do. But you can't go around thinking, I'm going to create a perfect system. It just won't work. That means that we really need something else. Something else that assumes that we're going to mess up. That we're going to have faults. We're going to have unintended requirements during the life of our software. How do we deal with unintended consequences? Unintended requirements in the course of software. How do we respond to those in real software systems?
Panic?
No. Mature organizations expect that their software is going to evolve.
It's generally through their software development methodology.
Yes, okay, there's a methodology. But how do they know what to change when? I mean, you have to, before you can change your software, you in effect have to change your requirements. Because that's the thing, it's imperfect, but it's still the thing that's saying, the software is supposed to do this, so you go from that to actually making it do that. How do you evolve your requirements?
Request for change. Analyze the change, plan the change, implement, request, implement.
Yeah. But what request, where do requests for changes come from? Here? They come from external input. They come from measurement. It's like, okay, you want to deal with performance problems, you instrument your software, you watch for changes in performance, you look for bottlenecks and optimize. For usability, you do user studies. You do user studies, you get real-time feedback from users, you watch the time it takes them to complete tasks, you see, you know, oh look, you know, someone has, you know, they have these shopping carts, and then they seem to, you know, put things in their shopping cart and then never do anything with it. And so you may do a test, like, oh, they can't figure out how to check out.
Couldn't you do the same with like penetration testing?
So this is what I'm getting at, is thinking about it. So we evolve our requirements by looking at how software is used in practice. And the people who use it and the systems themselves, we get feedback from. We watch the performance of the system. We talk to the users that are using it. We watch how the users use the system. We take all of that as data, as input to the software engineering process. And we go, okay, we are not, clearly, we need to make a new requirement because we see this problem. And now that requirement then filters through, and then we figure out how to engineer the software to satisfy that requirement. Do we do that for security? So what's in the common thing is like, okay, I've set up a firewall. How do I know the firewall's doing its job? How do I know it's blocking things that it should be blocking? How do I know it's not blocking things that it shouldn't be blocking? How do I know it's working right?
Well, that's what I was saying. If you get someone who is well versed in these areas.
So penetration testing, we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah, I'm not specifically talking just penetration. Like, it could just be like functionally, like, you know, looking for behavior with the hardware, stuff like that.
I think that's definitely part of it.
Wouldn't you just log everything that it does and then analyze the logs and decide from there?
What you're getting at is that security is a property like any other. What is your system? Are people attempting to break into it? Are they getting anywhere with it? Are there, you know, are systems falling over, which looks like under attack? I mean, that's kind of the high level thing. But then when you really think about it, it's a little tricky. So there is a difference when you're looking for trying to evolve your security requirements compared to other requirements. And what's the difference?
I think cash money is the difference, because if you have a system and you have like a million users who are like, I'll save time and money if there was a submit button here, then you have a good business case for it. But if you're like, we should improve security because there's this small slight security hole here, then the boss will be like, how much will that cost? Well, how's that going to pay off? No one's ever exploited that.
The business case is certainly not so easy to make. You can do a risk analysis and do things, but the business case certainly makes it hard. But it's even worse than that. That's part of the problem, but that's not the most insidious part.
I guess you'd never know if it wasn't working.
Part of it.
I was going to say that attackers are trying to hide what they're doing.
That's it. It's as if your performance bug was trying to pretend that it was running at full performance. Or it's that your users had an incentive to say, oh, the system works completely well, when in fact it's horribly unusable. When you introduce those things where deception is, where the thing you're trying to measure is actively trying to deceive you, it makes your problem a lot harder. So the thing that is commonly called, the thing that you deals with SOP, you know that your system's going to fail, you know that you're going to have problems, is
intrusion detection.
And this is a much maligned area. This is something near and dear to my heart. I've been doing research related to this for a very long time. I have a lot to say about this. I'm not going to say it now. What I am trying to do is say is just trying to again draw that, you know, it's still relatively, we're still kind of early on in this, in the course. We're not that early anymore, but but understand what's missing. You can't appreciate something until you understand why you need it. And this is all about saying, why didn't we just engineer? We talk about software vulnerabilities. Okay, this one. Why can't we just engineer them away? The reason we can't engineer them away is because they're fundamentally problems of requirements, and that you have to understand the problem in order to deal with them. And so, so you will have evolving requirements. It's painful to deal with changing requirements, like any software engineering problem. But the piece that makes it particularly hard is that the things that you would want to measure to see whether you have those problems are actively trying to deceive you. So how do you measure things that are trying to deceive you? That's the problem you have to solve. If you can solve that measurement problem, then you have input that you can feed into your software development process and also into the process of actually maybe trying to stop the attacks as they occur. So you get this operational thing, which again is the same thing as performance monitoring. Performance monitoring, if you're doing it in real time, you notice, oh my God, that server's falling down. I better fix it now before our entire business goes down the tubes. Yep. Instrumentation, you know, so the changing of the software is always something you do on a longer time cycle than actually trying, you know, to maintain the system. And this is the whole DevOps kind of mindset, is saying that, you know, you can't just separate production from development. The two have to be intertwined, and information from operation constantly feedback into development, so you have this ongoing process. And when you think of DevOps from a security perspective, it's just that writ large. But there's no magic here. There's no fundamental difference. There's a difference in the nature of the problem. And the problem difference is just about deception. If it had a very clear measure of saying, oh look, someone's breaking into my system, you would have a clear requirement for changing your system. But they're hiding it. And so you have to now think about, okay, now not only I have to now do measurement in an adversarial environment. And that's something that other folks don't have to deal with. And that's what makes security special.
So bug bounties are basically a way to try to solve that problem in a way, right? Get people to report problems.
Yep, exactly. Bug bounties are a software engineering hack. It's basically a way of incentivizing, it's a way to incentivize individuals not to be deceptive. Saying, I'm going to pay you not to be deceptive. I want you not, you find the vulnerability, and rather than exploiting it and stealing money from us, I'm just going to pay you money and for you telling me how you could get in. That's all it. But now you see why a bug bounty, how it's useful, and also its limits. Because anytime you do that, there's a cost-benefit calculation.
It's actually pretty smart because now you're crowdsourcing. So like all the people who don't find bugs, you're getting them to work for free. And second of all, when they come and say, we found this bug now, you can put a money value to it and say it's worth paying to fix.
So bug bounties for well-written software are actually not crowdsourced.
No.
At all.
Just because no one has the skill to be involved?
I'm saying because a crowdsourcing implies someone that the individuals who only spend a little bit of time, like they're working on some small piece of the system, some little area, they'll find a little problem, say, oh, look, there's a problem, and then tell you about it. I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I'm saying that's not how most of these things are found, not that most people get paid. The people who get these bug bounties are people who spend their time looking for those problems. And in order to find those problems, they are very good at analyzing code and analyzing systems. They have very specialized skill sets. They're very skilled individuals. And they generally work, I mean, I'm not saying there's a collaborative bug bounty hunting, but mostly these are individuals who are just very good at poking at systems. And then they share what they learn, and then maybe someone builds on that, but it's this targeted analysis. It's going deep. It's just like if you're programming something, and you're programming a tricky algorithm, I mean, yeah, you can talk to your neighbors and talk to your friends and colleagues and get them help and suggestions, but really at the end of the day, someone has to sit down and do a design and think through it, at least part of it, and then someone else can then look at it and critique it and do things. But the design, I mean, it's just like, you know, even writing text. Collaborative writing is really the process of people writing parts. Well, someone generally has to have some sort of argument. People writing parts, and then you try to integrate it together into a whole. And security analysis, I mean, it's about diving deep into how a system works. And it's not wisdom of the crowd. But it is saying these people's skills are valuable and could be used in other contexts. So let's give them a market so they can use their skills in ways that, you know, incentivize good outcomes rather than saying they love, you know, some people just love doing this. So give them a positive outlook for it. So there's a question.
I was just going to mention Google's Project Zero.
Project Zero, yeah. What Google's Project Zero is Google has hired some very good, very good folks that, you know, are basically just who are going around breaking systems left, right, and center.
Yep.
You know, but you know, and what they, but it's not like Google like specifically. They are just paying they're giving them two things. They're paying their salary. And they're giving them an environment in which to work in which they'll be supported for doing what they're doing. So,
I think I also heard recently that Google is about to open up like a consulting, like, with different Google subsidiaries there.
So, how many of you know about Google Project Zero? Probably no. So what it is Google has, so bug bounties are where, let's say, you know, Microsoft or Mozilla or something says, you find a software, a security vulnerability, tell us about it, and we'll pay you money. It's very simple. And the more severe of a security issue you find, the more money we pay you. Sometimes it's hundreds of thousands of dollars or more for a really severe security vulnerability that they found. Google's Project Zero is a team in Google that goes around finding security problems in other people's systems. They go around and post, oh, Microsoft, you've got a problem in Windows right here. And oh, Facebook, you've got a problem right there. And Project Zero is a bit notorious because they're... So let me talk about disclosure. So you going and you're hunting through code. And you find a logic error, or you find something that could be a backdoor. Who do you tell? And how do you tell them? Now, if you're working for, you know, a government spy agency, or you're working for organized crime or something like that, maybe you tell your colleagues and then they weaponize it and then they turn it into some way of earning money or potentially attacking foreign targets or whatever. But let's say you're not part of such an organization, and you just find this. What do you do with it? This is dangerous knowledge. People who find major security vulnerabilities have in the past been arrested, prosecuted, and even put in jail. Because when you find these things, they will find some law that you have violated. Some criminal hacking things, and so you're, it's like, okay, now you're and a company, or just simply, maybe it's not criminal, maybe it's just simply you'll be sued. Because now you found something, and I mean, it's just like a whistleblower in any sort of environment. Whistleblowers in any context are no one's friends. The greater public's friends, but the organizations that are being affected by it, they're the enemy. And someone who, when you find a bug in a program that could lead to a security vulnerability, you are being a whistleblower. So what do you do? So the traditional way of doing things was, okay, you find this, you report it quietly to the software vendor. You send in a little report quietly. Even if you do it quietly, you still can get in trouble. They might still sue you, or they might just put a gag order on you to say you, so you can't tell it. So, but you know, that's the kind of thing you tell them. But oftentimes, even if they don't go after you directly, they'll just sit on it. Because they'll go, hey, yeah, it's a theoretical problem. No one's actually exploiting it. Who else would find this? What's the big deal? The impact isn't that severe anyway. They'll make up excuses for not doing things. Because to do anything is expensive. Sometimes very expensive for systems that are difficult to operate. So organizations historically have just said, have basically wanted to be, to stick their head in the sand and just ignore the problem. So, but then this movement came along called full disclosure. The idea of full disclosure is you find a vulnerability and you tell everyone at once. Typical thing was you'd post it to a mailing list. There was this great mailing list called BugTrack. I don't think it's still around, but the BugTrack mailing list was good. TRAQ would, you know, people would just post things. And they'd say, oh yeah, I found the security vulnerability. And sometimes, not only would they post that they found the security vulnerability, they'd include helpful exploit code in the email that they posted to this mailing list, which effectively is going out to the world. Or to anyone who could do something. So now it's like, so that's full disclosure. It's like, I'm going to tell. And the reason for saying full disclosure is saying, well, the bad guys potentially already have this. They might be exploiting it now. And so you better tell people so they can protect themselves. And they go, well, why'd you include the exploit code? Now you just made an attack. The attackers can develop their own exploit code. The good guys won't know. And a lot of times, good guys won't take it seriously. They're like, oh, no one can break that. Oh, that won't work. You describe the vulnerability, they don't believe you. An exploit is the ultimate proof of saying, yes, there is a security vulnerability. See, run it. You know, what does everyone say? Can I reproduce the bug?
Yes.
The exploit is how you show you can reproduce the bug. And that's generally considered helpful in software engineering's, you know, practice, right? But you're going, oh, that seems kind of bad, right? Because now all of a sudden you've publicized this bug, and now all of a sudden maybe millions of systems are vulnerable. And it turns out that attackers, most of the time, when they do exploits, they use publicly known vulnerabilities and exploits. People always talk about, oh, it's the one no one knows about. No, no, the ones no one knows about are extra valuable. They are only used in certain circumstances. You don't just tell everyone. It's like, it's much more useful that. The ones that compromise those systems are like, oh yeah, everyone knows about that vulnerability. Have you updated your system? No. That's not in our patch schedule. We're going to be updating to that next quarter because we have a schedule for when we do updates. So we're going to leave our systems like this because they often have good reasons for doing this, because to patch systems can lead to instability, and then the system goes down, and then, you know, that's a bigger business problem. But that means that there's this window of opportunity for people to exploit. So there's this problem of full disclosure is potentially very dangerous, but it's like, okay, then it gets out there, and you know, versus just tell the vendor and then they sit on it. So now what's happened is places like Google Project Zero have very strict timelines. They will tell the software vendor that we found a vulnerability. And most of the time, once they've done it, a timer starts. And the timer is, what, 90 days, I think?
Yeah.
So they say, we've told you, you have 90 days. After 90 days, we're telling the world. I said, but we need more time. 9 days. But I'll have it. 9 days. And they are brutal. I mean, and in the 9 days, and they just let the world know. And everyone takes them very seriously because they have found some really bad stuff, and they have been really brutal about saying, you know, we're going to tell everyone. Hmm?
Like recently, the Bluetooth bug in the driver's side.
I don't even follow all the things.
So there was stuff. So there was a bug in most Bluetooth stacks, where basically you would have full access to the system because of Bluetooth.
Oops. Kernel driver vulnerability, basically.
Basically.
Okay, that's bad because that means anyone getting in Bluetooth range has control of your system.
It included Linux and Windows and Mac OS X, I believe.
And how long did they wait to tell everyone?
Like 90 days, I guess.
Yeah.
You might say, but I'm going to need longer to fix all the systems. The problem is the longer you go without people knowing there's a problem is the longer that someone will find out or something, and then now they're going to be exploiting it quietly. But if you publicize it, then the attackers definitely are going to start exploiting it because now it's a publicly known thing. The full disclosure debate rages on. Just recently with Meltdown and Spectre, there was this big hullabaloo over like who got told. Because it turns out that some folks were told and other folks weren't told. Like the big ISPs and like Amazon and you know, Google and Microsoft, they all kind of knew about this, but like, you know, folks in the general development community didn't know about this. And then there were these weird things like the Linux kernel mailing list, the Linux kernel development. People were putting out patches. And the patches were for changing how memory management was done in Linux in these very big ways. And people were going like, why are you doing these updates? What's the thing? And they're kind of going, well, it's for a problem. It's to help with a bug. And they just kind of kept trying to kind of say, you know, to downplay it and not talk about it until finally, do you know the thing that really pushed out in the open?
Kernel page table isolation.
Well, it's the kernel page table isolation was the feature.
Yeah.
And the reason why it really hit the wires and everyone started going, oh crap, was because AMD posted a patch with basically saying, this doesn't affect AMD chips. This isn't our problem. And so, doing this thing, it's like, it's not AMD's problem? Then whose problem is it? Huh! And I think they had some snarky comments in the commit or something, and people look at it, it's like, and that's when it's like, oh, wait, what? Wait, you're people started putting the things together and stuff, and it was like three teams that independently kind of discovered this and started like doing this around the same time. It was a very weird thing, because it wasn't one team that was like, three teams separately discovering that the information was going around. It's like, oh, we better tell everyone. Because they actually had a timeline they were supposed to tell them like this one date, and then they disclosed it like a week earlier. And because it was like everyone was already finding out, so we, you know, Google kind of put out the whole thing, and all the sites went up, and then even the folks that had been told early were now scrambling to get their fixes out, and then everyone else was going, what? There's a problem? And then literally there's this whole thing, because anyone who runs any sort of cloud provider, I mean any sort of like your VMs and stuff, are really like, oh crap. They're just, and so this is the full disclosure thing. It's the, how do you tell people? Especially if it's a major problem.
Well that was, I mean, as soon as Windows gave me an update that I could not postpone with a 3-day deadline. that was like early November, right? So I was like, no, something's coming out.
Yeah, there was, yeah, exactly. So let's talk about some very, how much time do we have now? Let's see, where are we? Okay, so we're good. Let's pick a software vulnerability to talk about, or a logic error. So let's step back. Where do we, if I'm going to start listing the kind of software vulnerabilities that we have, Why am I listing these? What makes these special? I give you a list of, these are classic kinds of software vulnerabilities. What's special about this list versus other kinds of errors? Because, of course, the transformation of the ways you can make security problems, you know, it's unbounded, the kind of things you could do to lead to a security problem. There's all kinds of crazy things. But I can put you a list up here of major soft classes of software vulnerabilities. Why, what's the relationship between these two? It's actually pretty simple. The list I'm going to give you is the list of security problems people know to look for. They're the ones that attackers, when they're looking for a system, they go, that's gonna be a problem. That's probably gonna, that they might have made that mistake. And so developers have to go, did I make that mistake? I better check. I mean, it's like grammar mistakes. How many ways can you mess up grammar? Especially in a language like English. English is just, you know, crazy grammar. How many ways can you mess up? All kinds of ways. But there are common grammatical mistakes. Things like a comma splice. You have two clauses that you want to connect together. You really should use a conjunction or something. But you just use a comma to separate them. That is not grammatically correct. You shouldn't do it in your writing. People do it all the time. So if you're a copy editor and you're looking through, you know, writing, you're going to, you say, oh yeah, there's a comma splice. Circle it. CS. Like that little quick notation, they just go on. It's not that the people who are copy editors are really like understand all the rules of grammar or anything like that. They're doing pattern matching. And they have a set of common mistakes that are in their head that they look for, and they're doing this. The list of common security vulnerabilities is the exact equivalent. It's a set of common grammatical mistakes. Errors that people make that lead to problems. Except in this case, instead of someone just reading the sentence and, oh, that sounds awkward, it sounds like that, it leaves your system being compromised. Humans are humans, but code is code. So we listed some, I don't want to go through the whole list right now, I just want to talk about one. And I'm not going to talk about buffer overflows. What I am going to talk about instead is SQL injection. So I'm picking this because it's not quite so commonly there, but it's kind of brain dead, but in a way that's still very hard to avoid. So first off, when we say what is SQL or SQL, people say SQL. SQL is what I say, but people say SQL, whatever. SQL, SQL injection.
The reason they say SQL is the original iteration of the language was SQL, S-E-Q, because there's something included English and that other thing. And then as it evolved, the first commercial actual was SQL, but the original.
The original thing was spelled out.
For system R was spelled out, yeah.
Wasn't that one a successor to Alpha?
Hmm?
Wasn't there a thing called Alpha before that?
Yeah, but Alpha was never implemented at all. So System R, which...
So you're saying this is a backronym?
Yeah.
That's good to know. That's a sequel to what? Is that the Alpha? Okay. Yeah, we'll say sequel. Okay. Because, SQL is a pretty dumb kind of acronym. It makes more sense. Okay, so SQL injection. What is this?
It's a query language.
It's a query language. What's a query language?
A language used to query databases?
So querying databases. So it's a language for databases. Which, what is that really? When you say a language and database, what is it really?
It's interpreted.
It's a programming language for databases. It's a domain-specific programming language for databases. It is optimized for making queries, but it is certainly Turing complete. You can do arbitrary computations in most versions of SQL. So, domain-specific programming language. So I'm just sort of stepping that up and saying, okay, you have a domain-specific programming language. How do you use domain-specific? So why is a domain-specific programming language a potential security problem? It's a language. What's the big deal?
Because if someone understands it, they understand the underlying structure of how the data is being stored.
Kind of, but
deals with special characters, etc., differently. So something that your language you're programming in just passes through.
So here's the little thing: is the programming language fundamentally problematic? Is just having a domain-specific programming language bad? No.
The software is not written in the same language, so you have to bounce between them.
No. When you talk about SQL injection, I mean, often the attack, you can use it in other things, but it's just, you know, losing access to your database is kind of bad. It's a programming language for, you know, it's a programming language for a specific domain. Domain-specific programming languages aren't necessarily a bad thing. What is bad is dynamically generated code. And most of the time, a lot of times, when people use any sort of domain-specific language in an application, they dynamically generate that code. Why are you dynamically generating? It's because you couldn't generate the code at compile time, or when you first wrote the system. So what does that mean? Where'd you get the full code? Using user input. So what is this really? You have dynamically based on untrusted that, you should go, we're in trouble. And that's why SQL injection is a common problem. Because the easiest way to use SQL is you have a template string, you take the user input, you stick it into the string, and then send it off to the database. You have a new thing and you send it off, and that's just the easiest way to do things. But when doing that, you've made a program using arbitrary user input and sent it to your database. What instructions did you give to the database? It's in part based upon whatever the user input provided. That's the whole point of doing this. You might think, well, they can just change the exact thing you heard. No, they can inject arbitrary code into that. That's what SQL injection is. It's saying that, oh, you gave me the ability to stick a substring into your larger program, I can make that substring into an arbitrary program that does whatever I want. Now you might say, well, and then there's lesser forms of SQL injection where it's
Okay, maybe they tried doing something to constrain how the dynamically generated code was put together. Okay, you did some trick, but now the attacker has a little game of saying, okay, you put these constraints, how much damage can I do?
So I guess SQL's a problem because it is so powerful. It doesn't just query, you can manipulate it and the data as well, so you can draw tables.
You can do arbitrary manipulations of the database and arbitrary other computations. So you have full access to the data and computation go with it. It's really up to the attacker what they can do with it.
You could have create a denial of service on the database by locking everything.
That's probably the nicest thing you could do.
Yeah.
You know, that's the attacker being nice to you, just to show you, yeah, I'm here, I locked all your data.
The attacker could steal the information, sell it to the black market.
Yep. So, but these are all natural consequences of what you can do when you control the system. Right? And the classification for this is unsanitized input. It's like, oh, look, you've created, before to understand a vulnerability, you have to understand the problem. And when you look at these problems, when you understand the right perspective, you see them just the same thing again and again and again and again and again. And the problem is that this is a large class of strategies. Is that you make dynamically generate code based on untrusted input. If you understand this is what you're doing, then you can kind of go, okay, let me figure out how to do this. But you have to see it. And people often don't see SQL as a real language. They see it as just a way of getting data from a database. Let's deconstruct this a little more. When we say dynamically generated code based on untrusted input, why the heck is there a full interpreter here? I just want to make a query. I just want to get one value from the database. Why do I have to deal with an entire programming language?
Well, because without it, your database wouldn't be very useful, right? Because the people writing the database wanted you to be able to do a lot of different things with it.
What is that really? What's really saying is, I want to solve this problem. I need this much functionality. But I have this much functionality. Actually, this is probably a couple orders of magnitude larger. I need this much functionality, and I have this much functionality. Much of what we have in computer science and in computer security, when we look at problems, is this. I just wanted to make a simple query. I just wanted to look up the username and get a password. I have an authentication table. I just want to structure a query, stick it in there, and get it out. But I have to do all this elaborate stuff to look at that username and make sure it isn't SQL code. I mean, that's in effect what you have to do. If you want to stick it into the SQL statement, you have this template, but then you have to take that username and rather than stick it in, which will work all the time. It'll work without flaw. Even for wrong usernames, it will do what it's supposed to. But if someone then sticks in a really weird username, like, someone posted the classic XKCD one to it. Johnny Drop Tables. Bobby Drop Tables.
So there's a company registered in the UK last year called Drop Tables Company.
That's mean. But you see, like, it's just, you stick some otherwise relatively innocuous things, like, put a semicolon here, you put a colon here, put some square brackets, and all of a sudden now, the system that's just supposed to be storing the data starts doing all kinds of crazy things. like deleting the entire, you know, entire tables. It's just, like, why is that functionality there? I do not need that functionality. It has no purpose here. Yet, it's sitting there right on the border with this other stuff. So, I mean, most of the time when you talk about things like SQL injection, it's easy to go, well, how do I solve SQL injection? Okay, what I need to do is before constructing, you know, I have to get my input, I have to sanitize the input, by removing all special characters, removing the alphabet and things, and then I can stick it into my SQL statement and then I know it'll work. I may remove keywords. I'm not saying that doesn't basically fix things. There aren't, you know, there's standard ways of building it, but if you don't see the larger problem, you can't see, like, this is endemic. This is everywhere. We keep doing this. And it's because of how we like to build software systems. We like to take these big components that have incredible numbers of features and take a small piece of function, because, like, that's all we need. How many times have you, when building an application, incorporated a library that was huge, and you used one function from it? Yeah. One function. A function with, if you were honest, would have probably taken you 20 minutes to write.
And, but I could have written it with a logic error.
Well, it's true. You could have made, you want to make it, and then sometimes good reason, because you go like, okay, yeah, I could have probably written one version, but I might have made mistakes with it. I might not have done it. I might as well use someone else's debug code. But you use their debug code, and you get everything else. And then you have this entire thing of like, I didn't mean to be generating code dynamically. I was just making a database query. But, you know, it's like, I thought I was using a butter knife and it was a chainsaw. So certainly part of my focus in this class, what I want you to do, is to see the patterns that lead to security problems. And this, I would say, is one huge pattern, is having access to lots of functionality and using a small part of it. And there not being a clear boundary between using that part of the functionality and everything else. As we want our software to be maximally flexible. Because if it's flexible, then it'll be easier to change requirements. So today, you only needed this query, but tomorrow you're going to want to make a different query. How hard will it be to do the different query? I could have just made a specialized data structure to solve this one query, but now when you tell me I need to do this other thing, oh, now I have to change my data structure completely. This is how databases come about. Rather than me messing with all these data structures and trying to make them persistent and stuff, then I can deal with concurrency issues, I'll stick it in a database. I get concurrency for free, and I get all these nice ways of querying it and stuff like that, and I don't have to worry about that problem. Someone else has solved it all. But now I have a different problem, which is now I have this very functional system that I need to do things with based on user input, and if I let things leak through now, you know, I've lost all my integrity, confidentiality, availability guarantees. These are reasonable trade-offs, but that's why security often goes in the toilet.
And this is why we use libraries for SQL.
Which can have vulnerabilities.
They can.
No, again, but this, so there's all this sort of best practice around things. And if I were just gonna, like, if I were to talk to you for 2 days, you know, like over 2 days, and just say, how do I do this? And I've had courses like this. If you're going to do this, like, if you're going to do database queries, use a standard library that does things securely. Don't write your own SQL statements, you know, your own SQL statements, because if you write your own SQL statements, you're probably going to use it using your untrusted input, and you're going to make mistakes. So instead, use the programmatic interface, which will automatically escape any special characters and make sure that your query is clean. That's one piece of advice. I can give you that advice. I can then give you advice for how do I avoid cross-site scripting. I can give you that advice.
How do I avoid buffer overflows? I can give you that advice. How do I avoid, you start listing these things, I can tell you that advice. But you won't see the pattern. And that's what I want you to see. Because then, when you start implementing a domain-specific language, or start using it, and then you start doing it, you might go, that could be a problem. How am I going to make sure that that's going to be, can be used in an untrusted environment? I want you to see the problems before they become problems. And then, because that's really what it means to write secure code, is you just sort of see the patterns and then say, okay, it's not that you're not going to make mistakes. It's that you make choices, design choices, that make your mistakes have lower impact. That's what it means to write secure code. It means when I mess up, I don't lose everything. Things break a little bit. And it breaks in a way I can observe.
There was actually a logic error in Steam's bash script where if a particular variable ended up being unset, it would literally delete everything beginning at the at slash.
Ooh.
And I believe it was running as root.
Yeah. So again, what were we just hearing about there? Not SQL injection, shellcode injection.
Not even injection, just a logic error.
Yeah, but wait, that's just a logic error. Okay, so.
So you mean like then somebody going through and finding a path variable that the user control and changing the path that the program is pointing to or something like that?
I'd have to look exactly you know what it is. So I'm saying, let's focus on this here. So with the where else do you see dynamically generated code? Other people? This was kind of
you have like any sort of like bash calls in your program?
So where do you have, so there's the shell. I need it. When do you get shell code? It's whenever you do, so if you do an explicit exec VE, you control everything, that's just going straight to the kernel. But if you do, there's also these calls like system, or something where you just give it a string, which is a full command line. So you have the command you want to do and all the arguments. If you do that, a shell is invoked to parse it. You could have had, just in the C library, some very simple things that just split apart the string and turned it into an exec VE thing and didn't do any sophisticated parsing. But no, we already have a shell. It already does this for you all the time very efficiently. Why don't we just have the shell do it? And so now, arbitrary shell scripts can be run. As, again, with the same kind of thing. It's like you're providing some little text. It's being sent off to an external program. It's running a command line. And now it's in the command line, and now you're embedding arbitrary shell scripts. Running as whoever invoked it. Darn it. It's the same problem. Same difference.
Mm-hmm.
Cross-site scripting would be the same thing, same kind of problem.
Partially, yes. The reason why I say partially is that, how are we doing time-wise? We're just about time. I'll end with this. So cross-site scripting is not necessarily cross-site, it is not necessarily scripting. It's a horrible term. Let's say there are cases of JavaScript injection. That's normally if you do things like eval in your code, which people do in JavaScript. Anyway, we're out of time. We will continue talking about software vulnerabilities, and I will have assignment 2 up by our next class.
Hey, huh?